This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Nicholas Vince. He is an actor. He is best known for playing the role of Chatterer in the films Hellraiser 1 and 2. Nicholas, it is great having you on.
Thank you very much. I've been looking forward to chatting to you guys.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pillator, and J.G. Michael, who's a big Hellraiser fan, is joining us too.
What's up?
Hey there.
Hiya.
Hey.
So I know this is going to sound really silly, but you kind of have this experience like where you watch a Hellraiser film for the first time, and you're like lying in your bed in the dark, and you have this kind of image of a Cenobite like looming over you, and then here I am like talking to you right now.
That doesn't sound silly at all. One of the things I've learned over the years is just how powerful an effect that Hellraiser has had on people. The Cenobites really have become iconic in terms of the depth in which they've affected people's psyches. I remember being at a convention once, and a young lady came up and she said, "I just have to tell you, Chatterer was always my favorite Cenobite. I always found him the most scary. And my girlfriend, you know, when we were kids, one of my best friends, she was staying over one night, and I was telling her that Chatterer is real, and that actually he was based on a true story, and he lived up, and she was somewhere in the middle of America, and she's saying, Chatterer lives in the local woods." And apparently, this was told about 10, 15 years ago, but to this day, in that town, young people talk about the fact that Chatterer lives in the local woods. So I get that. I understand how deeply the Cenobites can affect people.
I think the first Hellraiser film I saw, you were in the first two. The first one I saw was actually Hellraiser Inferno. And right. I found that one the most disturbing, but it was more kind of the theme of like the psychological torture, which was very effective in that one.
So I'm trying to remember if I've actually seen Hellraiser Inferno. Give me an eye, and perhaps for the listeners,
kind of give it. Chatterer is in that one, but it's about a corrupt police detective who solving this puzzle, but then at the end he finds out that he's stuck in hell.
Right. So this is the detective is played by Craig Sheffer, who's in Nightbreed. And the Chatterer, I think, in that one is the half torso Chatterer.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. That was the scene where the twin female Cenobites try to seduce the main character.
Yeah, yeah. And you get the Chatterer kind of coming up the stairs or down the hallway. And I think that the sound of the chattering that you hear, because you hear the chattering first before you see the character. This half torso, just walking on his arms. I think I've seen that sequence either on YouTube or partway through the film. What I find interesting about the Chatterer is that actually, he, apart from Pinhead, basically there is a version of Chatterer in all the subsequent, I didn't play them obviously, but in most of the subsequent movies, Chatterer appears in some sort or another. I think in Bloodline, there's a Chatterer dog, which reminds me of another great question.
Oh, is that the one that goes back to the original French inventor who created the Lament configuration?
That's right. Yes, absolutely. Lemarchand or Lemarchand, however you want to pronounce it. And then ends up in space. I thought that was quite an interesting film. But I do love the fact that you have a Chatterer dog in it. Again, one of the nicest questions I got asked during a Q&A was by a 9-year-old boy at a Q&A who asked whether or not the Chatterer dog in Bloodline is Chatterer's dog in hell.
Huh.
And which I think is great. I'm not sure that 9-year-old...
I think it must have been about like 25 the first time I saw them. I mean, I was born in 85, so I was probably too young to see the original when they came out.
Yeah, because you'd have been 1 or 2 years old Yeah. Yes, because next year, this year, 2017. Yes, the first one came out in 1987. So this year is the 30th anniversary of the release of the first Hellraiser.
Can you talk about the sort of what it was like to be on the set, especially the scene where in the Hellraiser 2 where they filmed like the hell sequence? Was that filmed in London?
When you say the house sequence, do you mean the...
It's like the labyrinth scene where it's sort of like an M.C. Escher-like maze.
Oh, right. Sorry, yeah. The maze sequence. Sorry, yeah. Got you.
Well, yeah, all of them deal with... Like, a lot of them deal with the theme of being in hell, but in a sort of surreal sense. This Hellraiser 2 is the only one that depicts hell in a physical sense.
Yeah, I think the... I remember it very well, obviously. I think basically the real difference between filming Hellraiser and Hellbound, the second one, was we filmed Hellraiser in a tiny little place called the Production Village. And then in Hellbound, we were actually in Pinewood Studios. So all that stuff was built. I didn't get to go into the labyrinth. I saw the set, but Chatterer doesn't actually appear in the labyrinth itself. Because you've got... And basically, they, you know, it's the classic trick. You've got a length of corridor with a couple of turns in and so on. So they basically move set pieces around to make it appear that you've got different... And dress them slightly differently. So, yeah, I mean, the exciting thing was that it was actually filmed in proper studios, big Pinewood Studios near, you know, where James Bond films are made, at Pinewood Studios. So, yeah, it was fun. It was really, really good fun.
Was it uncomfortable being in the costume?
It was, yeah, ridiculous. On the first movie, I literally, once they got me in, I couldn't really hear, speak, or see. So it was, you know, it was challenging. It was really challenging, particularly on the first day, because the first time we walked on set and I had to be led, I mean, I could see a little. There was a tiny pinhole in the Chatterer mask where I could see out of my left eye looking downwards onto the ground, about 2 square feet of ground that I could see. But basically, it was great for my posture because it's all leather and it's all strapped, you know, zipped in tight and so on. And the mask was actually attached to the costume. So I really couldn't, literally all I could do was walk, chatter my teeth, move my arms and my hands a bit. Had to be led around by hand. And then I couldn't really hear what was being said to me in terms of directions. And the kind of, Clive and some were kind of giving me directions, and I just was not responding because people hadn't really appreciated how little input I was getting. Eventually, they worked out that they just had to stand quite close to me and shout, speak quite loudly to make sure I had heard and understood. So yeah, it was challenging. It was very challenging. Like I could be left. I think on the first movie, I was left in the makeup up and for up to 8 hours at a time. So yeah, that was tough. But hey, so much good has come out of it. I don't really mind.
And you also mentioned you got injured on one of the scenes with the sort of the fish. Was it the one with the fish hook? Is that the
inhale? Well, yeah, that's in the second movie. It's in the death sequence where I've got the pillar spinning behind me. And you'll notice by that stage I got eyes, or Chatterer had got eyes, so I could actually see where I was going and doing. There was a whole sequence about explaining how the eyes became to be revealed, but it never got included in the movie. Again, you couldn't recreate it if you'd really tried. You have a hook, the 12-inch rusty hook. It was basically the sort of hook that's used for moving sacks of rice.
Oh, is this the scene where they show the Cenobites in their human form?
That's right. Yeah. So basically, the idea was that Dr. Chouinard, played by Kenneth Cranham, was firing tentacles out of his hands, and one would hit me in the chest and then pin me to the spinning pillar, and the pillar would spin, and the child, the boy, would be revealed. What nobody had really noticed, because there was all kinds of crap hanging from these pillars, dildos, ridiculous things attached to these pillars. And this is a Clive Barker movie we're talking, after all. From the top, there was a piece of wood about 6 inches long sticking out. On the end of that was a chain. On the end of the chain was this big hook. And as I opened my mouth to scream, the hook went right into the roof of my mouth. It was kind of like, because it came with quite some force, because they were spinning quite, you know, kind of feeling what my head get knocked back. Realizing there was something in my mouth that shouldn't be there, and kind of like pulling it out with my hand, and then just saying, and just asking for the teeth that I was wearing, which are dentures. They were, so basically the chattering teeth that you see in the movie.
Did you have to constantly chatter, or they were?
Yeah. Yeah. That I practice in the bathroom at home. Literally. I was only going to do one thing in this movie. I was going to do it well. So basically, the teeth that you see are plastic teeth that are attached to my teeth on a denture. And as far as I'm aware, and no one's ever contradicted me, is that the sound, the chatterer sound that you hear in the movies, one and two, is me chattering these plastic teeth. I made sure those were got out. And then eventually they took me to the accident emergency.
That sounds a lot like in the Crow, when Bruce Lee's son would die by an accidental shot of a pistol gun. Hopefully you didn't die on that scene.
This would be a very strange conversation if I had actually died. But you never know.
I had a question actually that sort of ties into this. So New World Pictures, I think, did the first two Hellraiser films, right? Yes. What was the New World? It was founded by, I think, Roger Corman, and it was sort of a B movie studio. So was the shooting schedule kind of like hectic and, you know, crazy?
Well, you see, that's the very interesting thing. You're absolutely right. It was New World Pictures. Originally, New World Pictures was founded by Roger Corman, the king of B movies, and, you know, probably one of the reasons I'm into horror to begin with, was because I grew up watching Roger Corman horror movies with Vincent Price, the Edgar Allan Poe, Vincent Price, Roger Corman movies. So I remember when Clive told me who was producing, me getting very excited about, you mean Roger Corman? He said, yeah, unfortunately, Roger Corman had sold the company about 3 or 4 years earlier. So the people involved, so Roger wasn't involved, which is just mortifying as far as I'm concerned. I'd love to have met him. That's why that is New World Pictures. That's the background. So Roger wasn't directly involved, unfortunately.
Right. But was the studio still like sort of a B movie studio?
Sorry, yes, I'll come back to your actual question now. I was looking at the filming dates. It was actually quite a long shoot. We went over, what all I remember is Clive being Clive wanted this to be absolutely perfect. So we got a lot of overtime, because normally you knock off at 6 o'clock. We were getting in. Wasn't so bad for me. I mean, Doug was getting in about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. Doug Bradley, who played Pinhead, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning. And the makeup guys would have been in even earlier, preparing makeup, etc. But the aim would normally, you would finish about 6 o'clock. But we were finishing about 8, 9, nigh on 10 o'clock by the time we got out and got out of makeup, etc. So we, my memory is that I earned an awful lot of overtime, and that Clive was just, you know, took it, everything he did was absolutely to what he wanted. The budget, the numbers may be slightly off, but my memory is that the budget was $900,000 to begin with. But when the guys from New World, including a gentleman called Tony Randall, who's a producer who went on to direct the third film.
That would be considered relatively pretty low budget for a major film.
Oh, God, yeah.
But absolutely. Back then, was that considered low budget?
Yeah. Yeah, that's low. It's a low, low independent budget movie. All American money. And, yeah, I mean, the thing is, look, when they saw the rushes that Clive was producing, they actually put in more money. So I think the eventual budget was $1.1 million back in 1986 when we made it.
Have any of you guys read the novella Hellbound Heart?
Yes, I think it's over 30 years ago now. I can't remember if I read it before or afterwards. I suspect I read it before I saw the script. Was it published beforehand? I think it was published.
I listened to it on YouTube. Clive Barker does a reading of it. It's available.
Oh, really? It's a wonderful book. I mean, Clive writes so beautifully. The interesting thing, I mean, the only main difference between the original book and the film and the film script is, of course, that Kirsty in the book is the daughter, is not the daughter. She's a co-worker. So it's kind of an infernal love triangle, except there are four people involved if you count the dead guy in the attic. There's a lot more sexuality to it. And in fact, I think somebody
a prequel to the original one.
Say again?
It's a prequel to the Hellraiser films.
No. The Hellbound Heart is definitely the Hellraiser film is definitely based on Hellbound Heart. Apart from changing Kirsty to being a daughter rather than a friend of Larry's, then it's more or less the same story. And obviously, I think Clive's design of the Cenobites changed between writing the book and the film as well, because as Barbie Wilde, who plays female Cenobite in the second movie, will point out that in the original book the leader of the Cenobites is a female rather than a male.
Well, the thing is, I could be remembering it wrong, but I thought in the book I thought the Cenobites let Kirsty go after they get Frank. Am I wrong about that?
To be honest, it is so long since I've read it.
Yeah.
You could well be right.
Well, I think that's one of the most interesting things about Hellraiser. When I watch it, I don't really see the Cenobites as the main villains in the first two films, especially. It's Frank and Julia in the first one, and Julia and Dr. Chouinard in the second one, who I think are the real evil. You know, the Cenobites are just doing their job, really. You know?
Yeah, no, and Clive would love you for that comment, because I think that's how Clive had always seen it. What Clive thought he was doing is that he was creating a female villain in Julia, and he thought that Julia would be the character that went on from film to film. If that's what what happened, and then suddenly people just really latched onto the Cenobites. A lot of people from the, say, the masochistic fetish scene really championed Hellraiser.
Influenced by sadomasochist clubs?
Oh, absolutely. It was influenced by all sorts of things. I remember that there was a book called... Oh, there was a magazine that Clive showed me, which he'd used as kind of reference stuff, called Piercing Quarterly. And some of the images in there still make me cross my legs and cringe. I get goosebumps.
Are you a fan of John Norman's Gore series? I love those books.
I don't know it. I don't know them.
Oh, well, there was also a 1988 film called Gore, and Gore was like this old... It's kind of a science fiction series. He's still alive. He's one of those Ivy League philosopher professors. It's his pen name, but still, it's these weird sadomasochistic He-Man, and it has its own culture too. This Gore culture of I can't recall the name, but I've enjoyed a lot of those pulps, and some people think those pulps are dangerous reads. And if you ever find them for like 50 cents, they're worth getting any title with John Norman's name of the Gore books. You know, they're really cool. It reminds me of that.
That sounds really interesting. I mean, to be honest, I tend to read two. If I'm talking about reading, I will tend to, apart from Clive, obviously, a guy called Terry Pratchett mm-hmm. is probably my mm-hmm. favorite author. And I reread the books. Mostly I tend to read them because I tend to read last thing at night to kind of switch off from the day. The last thing I'm going to read before going to sleep is horror.
Are you immune from being disturbed from a horror film by acting in one?
No, not in the slightest. Is anybody who wants it? I am the biggest scaredy cat in the world. I am such a pussy. I am a wuss of the first order. I watch stuff and I enjoy horror. I enjoy intelligent horror. I'm not a big fan of stalk and slash.
Like these films like... Well, there's violence in Hellraiser, but Hellraiser is very creative and sophisticated. And I think the psychological torture is a lot more effective. A lot of these films that come out, like Hostel and The Human Centipede, it's more just like trying to shock people by coming up with the sickest, most violent stuff imaginable. But I think those films lack the creativity of Hellraiser.
Yeah, I mean, I think Hellraiser is a love story. It's a domestic tragedy. Hellraiser, you know, it's a love triangle with monsters. It's got a supernatural love story, if you like. And it's about Julia's passion for bringing her lover back. The fact that he's dead and she has to go out and murder people. The violence is very real. I think that's one of the things. It's like, if you were... I am a huge fan of Nightmare on Elm Street, but Johnny Depp's death in Nightmare on Elm Street is one of the silliest things I've ever seen. But the whole concept of somebody who can kill you whilst you are asleep, I found completely terrifying. So, I mean, I like things like that. This last year, I was at Fright Fest in London. One of the films that I've been championing is a film called Cruel Summer, which is basically about three teenagers who get bored. Well, it's more than that. It's more than the fact that they're bored. A lie is told. And one of them feels that it's basically belittling his masculinity. And he wants to go out and he thinks he's got to sort out a guy. And you know what's going to happen over 90 minutes, but it's one of the most riveting, soul-destroying watches I've done. There's not that much gore. There's no supernatural element to it, but it is terrifying. It's absolutely horrifying. Another one I saw was The Unkindness of Ravens by Laurie Brewster, which is all about a soldier... who is a British soldier, this is, Scottish to be more accurate, in Afghanistan. And you're following this man's descent into post-traumatic stress disorder. You're following his descent into madness. And again, I was actually sitting in the cinema thinking, I must remember to breathe. I must remember there is so much going on and I'm taking so much in. So yeah, I think, so no, I'm not immune. The sort of films, but having said that, one of my other favorite films is Lederhosen Zombies, which is just the silly, I kind of like the silly splatter movies, the most imaginative way of killing zombies. Those are kind of fun. I really do like those kind of things. But yeah, I mean, if it's just torture porn, if it's violence for violence sake, without any either kind of social commentary or something that reveals something of the human condition, then I'm just not interested. And as I say, I was brought up with Roger Corman, Edgar Allan Poe. That to me is, you know, the source of horror.
JG, do you want to ask a question about the film Nightbreed, since you've watched that? I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, actually, I thought that was a good segue. You talked about films with social commentary, and I feel like Clive Barker, a lot of his MO with his horror stories is sort of subverting the conventions of horror, making the other into the, you know, good guy or the neutral character, and the humans or the, you know, normal as yeah. the villain. And I feel like Nightbreed really brings that out. And I just wonder what you thought of the film and how it panned out, because I know the studio version, a lot of people were upset with it. I know Clive didn't like it, and the Cabal cut just came out.
Well, yeah, I think the you're absolutely right. When Clive was making the movie, we knew that it had gone massively over budget. We knew that, it was Morgan Creek who were the producers originally, and the producer, I can't remember the gentleman's name at the moment, who had commissioned it and, you know, given Clive the money originally, left halfway through the process, and it was his partner who took over, and he really just didn't understand what Clive was doing. You're absolutely right. Nightbreed is about the monsters are good guys. And I remember speaking to Clive during the editing process. He said, Nick, yeah. He was dealing with people who were saying to him, Clive, if you're not careful, people will start sympathizing with the monsters. And Clive's like, yes, that's the point. But yeah, that is what Nightbreed is about. And again, you know, if you want to read a really, really good book, read Cabal, the book on which you mentioned the Cabal Cut, Cabal on which the book is based. More important, and as well as the Cabal Cut, which went around the circuit, the director's cut, which is Clive's version, which is different to the Cabal cut, basically because they found the original lost footage and edited it together. It's a very different film. And again, funnily enough, it's a love story. Clive described it as Gone with the Wind with monsters. And again, the heart of the book Cabal and is a man who discovers, who's told he's a monster, becomes a monster, but it's about his love affair with his girlfriend, Laurie, and what she is willing to give up for the man she loves. But is again, against this backdrop of what is a monster?
Well, I was going to say the other thing too, I didn't mean to interrupt you, I'm sorry. It's also sort of mixes the slasher genre into it too, with David Cronenberg's character.
Again, we'll see that, and again, that's very astute, because in the studio version, yeah, they wanted, because basically I think what happened is that the guys, they'd seen Hellraiser, seen Hellbound. Well, Clive was writing Nightbreed whilst we were filming Hellbound. So he got Nightbreed on the back of Hellraiser, on the success of Hellraiser. And what the studio wanted was another Hellraiser, where the monsters are monsters. They go around killing people and slicing them up and tearing them apart with chains. And because that's what I think in their mind, that's what they were thinking was what made the success of the movie. And what they got was a movie where the monsters are good guys. And that, you know, you've got sympathetic monsters. So I think that's kind of where. So when they did their version of it, they concentrated on the fact that Cronenberg, David Cronenberg, who's playing Decker, the psychiatrist, is a slasher. And they put a lot of emphasis on him trying to make it into a slasher movie, which, of course, is never going to work because that's not what Clive had filmed.
Right, right. And how did David Cronenberg become involved in that? He's known for being a director of all these great body horror films, and it was kind of cool to see him acting as the villain in a movie.
He and Clive knew each other and were friends, as far as I understand it. I met David Cronenberg once when I was under 5 hours of makeup as Kinski. So David would never reckon that. And I literally just met him once. He was just a really good friend of Clive's. And Clive had asked him. And, you know, it's... I don't know if David had done any other acting before. And you could see it on IMDb, I guess. But, yeah, so I think that's... It's the usual thing. If you've got mates, you've got talented mates, you ask, you know, the first thing you do is ask them to see if they'd be interested.
You wrote the series What Monsters Do and Other People's Darkness. Can you talk about those?
Yeah, so these are collections of short stories. So this all happened about 2012, the first book came out, What Monsters Do. Yeah, I mean, I'd written... Funny enough, when we were making Hellbound, I'd already started writing short stories. I wrote as a kid. I wrote as a teenager. For my own stuff. And when you're a teenager, a good way of dealing with angst is to write. Just write. If you've got a whole load of problems and, you know, this is my advice in life. If you've got a whole load of stuff you're dealing with, just write down, just write what's not fiction. Just get it all out of your head because it's so much easier to deal with when it's on paper in front of you. So I've been writing as a form of therapy. And then I wrote fiction again, purely for myself. And then I was asked if I'd like to do a short story for a magazine called Fear. In the UK, and I wrote a short story based on The Chatterer so I helped publicize Hellbound when it came out. And then when we were making Nightbreed, I met a whole load of people, Neil Gaiman, John Bolton, the artist, who were involved in comics. And I got into writing Hellraiser comics for Marvel. In the year, Epic Comics, which was part of Marvel. I'd always written, and then basically I left acting, was writing comics, and then all my comics, I was writing monthly comics, I was writing for wrote Nightbreed comics, Hellraiser comics, a series called Warheads, a limited edition series called Mortigan Goth Immortalis. So I'd, been writing for ages. And then I was writing all these comics, and that's how I was supporting myself. And then all my comics were cancelled. And I discovered, I had no income and therefore £12,000 in debt. Needed to do something about it. Went into computers and then got made redundant in 2012. And about that time, this is when Kindle and Amazon and CreateSpace to create paperbacks was all happening, becoming very popular and taken seriously, if you like. So I just thought, I'm redundant. I've got some money. I'm going to do what I love and go back to doing what I love rather than working computers. And so I started writing short stories again. They've done very well. What Monsters Do is still... I think it was still 5 stars on Amazon throughout the world. I just started writing short stories.
I'm working on a novel, and I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but there's like one sequence that is influenced by a horror and even Hellraisers to a degree where the main character ends up in a psychiatric prison, and he's constantly being drugged, and there's all these like nightmare like sequences and dream sequences. So I was thinking about maybe putting in some like Cenobite like characters into the dream sequences, but I'm not sure yet.
I think it's interesting. I think we all bad writers steal. What is it? Bad writers borrow, good writers steal. I think we're all influenced by stuff. But I think the important thing is that even if you've got that as your jumping off point, what you do with it is uniquely yourself, is uniquely yours. I mean, you can, it depends how you handle it. What you have to, okay, if you've got, if that's your jumping off point, you then have to start questioning yourself and asking questions. This is my view of writing. You know, you have to find the twist. You have to find what's different. What are you bringing that is new to the party?
Because everyone borrows from previous writers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Shakespeare never wrote an original plot line in his life. Shakespeare based all his plays on either reports of, one of his final plays, The Tempest, was based on a book, the true story of an Italian count who'd been shipwrecked. And so on. But when you put that into Shakespeare's hands, he weaves in magic. He weaves in father-daughter relationships, and so on. So I think there are arguments to saying there are no new stories. Well, that's kind of true in some ways. There are archetypal stories that we tend to stick, you know, we're all influenced by and so on. But the characters that you bring in and the way they react to that particular situation, that's what makes it interesting. That is what is uniquely you. That is something only you can tell. Because I think all our art is based on our experience.
Mm-hmm. I know, with the sequence of Hell and Hellbound, do you know if was Clive influenced by Jim Henson's Labyrinth film, since that, I think that came out around the same time?
That's interesting. I don't... It's possible because, of course, Clive wrote the outline for Hellbound. The script was written by Pete Atkins, and Tony Randall, the director, obviously, you know, they were working together. I think, yes, of course. But then the film Labyrinth is influenced by Jason and the Minotaur. The Greek myth. So I think,
and also M.C. Escher too.
Yes. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the idea. Yeah. Well, Labyrinth is definitely M.C. Escher, because you have the great thing where he's actually, you know, where David Bowie is doing all sorts of weird and wonderful things, but, you know, stepping over the edge and so on. And again, you see that in, I think, in Harry Potter has got the eye. You know, Escher. You've got reference to, is made to Escher, where you've got staircases that are impossible, which is basically playing with perspective.
You mentioned the artist John Bolden. He's a comic artist. He does his work. It's like horror and erotica. I'm looking up one right now. It's really cool. It's like it kind of combines the two genres. You see the background. It's very 80s. It's kind of this blue purple. And purple wall, and you see this dead alien, then you see a woman shooting the alien, and she's wearing like nothing but a shirt, but she's completely nude.
Bolton's art reminds me that of like Sam Keith or some H.R. Giger stuff going on.
Yeah, I think John was a really good friend back in the days. We've kind of drifted apart now, as one does, different paths. A wonderful, wonderful man. Wonderful artist. John illustrated John illustrated one of my Hellraiser comics. And in fact, I modeled for John on a few occasions. In fact, one of the portraits I have in my study at home, like two of the portraits I have in my study at home are by John Bolton of me, because I used to do a lot of modeling for comics. I modeled for Dave McKean. For example, on his book Cages. But John is one of the things that's unique about John. He paints all his pictures. So each individual. Say again?
Are they watercolors?
He uses gouache, oil, oils, everything, watercolor, depending on what you're looking at. I mean, he can do pen and ink as well. I've seen his black and white stuff as well. But mostly he used to work. When I knew him as well, as gouache and acrylics oils. So literally every page is a work of art. You know, you could just take his complete frames. And he's got this very photographic, realistic, which I find really interesting in a lot of his work, the way he plays with light, particularly when he's doing aliens and monsters. And, you know, John's a very heterosexual man, and he loves his he loves his nubile women, scantily clad. Wonderful, wonderful artist, John Bolton.
Have you ever met Simon Beasley? He did the art for Lobo. I really like him. He's another.
Yeah, I probably did Simon Beasley. Yeah, I think I did. You see, when I was writing comics, I became involved in it's the Comics Creators Guild. Simon Beasley, Liam Sharp. I don't know if you know Liam's work, who's created Made Fire comics. Liam Sharp, again, we were working for Marvel UK at the same time. Mark Buckingham, who's worked on an awful lot of work with Neil Gaiman. Yeah, I used to know all those guys quite well. But again, once I kind of left the comics world and went off and did other things like computers, I kind of lost touch with an awful lot of them.
I'm an artist myself. I mostly do kind of cityscapes and interiors, but I have worked on a series of like vintage London, mostly like the vintage Piccadilly Circus, but I was also working on one of the old like Raymond's Review Bar in Soho.
I used to work next door to Raymond's Review Bar in Soho.
Oh yeah, I heard that they've been like redeveloping that whole area.
Oh, completely and utterly. It's not like it was in the 1980s. Yeah, no, there used to be a small theatre upstairs next door, owned by Raymond, Paul Raymond, this is, who owned all the strip clubs and used to own one of my favourite clubs, Madame Jojo's, which is the transvestite club in Soho. But yeah, I've seen some of your work, Robert. It's very good. I love your use of colour and perspective. It's really nice, really, really interesting work. I'd love to see I'd love to see your version of Soho.
I'll send you a link to it when I'm finished.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, excellent.
I was going to ask, since you were talking about comic books, are you a fan of the old EC comic books, Tales from the Crypt, Vault of Horror?
Yes. Yeah. I remember, 1960s. Which is when I would have first come across those. I grew up in south of London, in a place called in West Sussex, in south of London. Terribly, terribly rural provincial, etc. Miles away from the big city. But I remember in our market, the weekly market, coming across the stall that had a few of these comics. And I was probably around about 10 or 12 when I had these things. I came across these things, and I can still remember some of them. I remember some of the stories. You know, there was, and I find it really interesting because obviously I'm sure you're aware of, you know, the comics code and so on. And they, you know, these things are terrible. They're all gore and violence and so on. Mostly they were terribly, terribly moral stories. Then we know.
What's interesting about those comics is William Gaines, who published them. I was watching a documentary on him. He was on like amphetamines and stuff when those were being written. You know, so it sort of explains a lot, I guess.
Yeah, I would imagine so. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think they were wonderful and beautifully drawn. And I think what's interesting is they were very. The artwork was very good from my memory of them. Some of it was a bit dodgy and some of the stories worked better than, you know, others, but to be able to do those kind of, it's a real, as I learned later in my life when I came to do short comic stories for Hellraiser, etc. That there's an art. I mean, I love the art form of comics because it combines both visuals and words. And, you know, that melting pot, I find absolutely fascinating. If it's done well, if it's done really, really well, you can get a real emotional punch from a well-written and well-illustrated comic. I think it's a really fascinating art form, particularly as you can have the picture juxtapose with the words. And you can also, you know, the expressions and so on, which makes them so much closer to film. And it was why you see so many comics being made into films, I think, because it's an easy leap of imagination for a producer, you know, somebody who's going to have to put down an awful lot of money to make a movie. It's an easier sell than just trying to say, okay, this book, which is nothing but words, to actually translate a comic into a movie is a much easier, I'm assuming, is a much easier sell.
I take it you grew up on the Amicus adaptations, the Amicus horror anthologies of Tales from the Crypt. And
yeah, we didn't. Of course, I grew up in the UK. We didn't have them. We didn't have things like that. As I say, my real first introduction to horror, okay, is Doctor Who. Is going to be Doctor Who, and I'm talking about William Hartnell, because I will have been watching the William Hartnell, in other words, black and white, 1963, 60, you know, the early 1960s onwards, when, and these were the most terrifying things that you'd see on, you know, literally, you watched it from behind the sofa. Or I used to watch it with a cushion on my lap so that if it got too scary, I could cover my face and cover my ears and so on. So we didn't really, so I know in America that they used to show Universal horror films, etc. We did not have anything like that in the UK. Doctor Who was probably the closest thing. You got some weird science fiction stuff. There was a thing called, funnily enough, they remade it recently as The Tomorrow People, but the original UK TV series, The Tomorrow People, shown around about 5 o'clock in the afternoon when everyone was home from school, going to the '70s, the 1970s, you got these weird kind of things going on. The first films that I saw were either the Universal black and white things like Frankenstein, Dracula, or the Roger Corman stuff. Mm-hmm. And those were shown at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night on a Friday. So, you know, we didn't, in the UK, it's a very different culture. So mostly the short stories that I would have been reading collections of short stories. We had the Pan Book of Horror anthologies. We had all these wonderful collections of short stories. H.H. Munro Saki is one of my favorite authors of short stories, of really chilling short stories. M.R. James. We did have this thing of, at Christmas, you always had a...
Ghost Stories of Christmas. Yeah.
Ghost Stories at Christmas. On Christmas Eve, on our BBC Two, we used to have M.R. James adaptations, 1970s. And these are the kind of, you know, that was really the only stuff that you got. So basically, I grew up without a lot of the influences you're talking about.
See, I was thinking about the Hammer horror movies, like Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee. You guys didn't grow up on that. I mean, that was from the UK.
It was from the UK. Those were, but then, of course, you couldn't go and see. Again, our films work very differently. I believe you could go and see this stuff with a parent. We were just banned. You're not allowed to see that kind of... Well, then, when I was growing up, you couldn't go and see a Hammer horror film until you were 21 years old. And then it was reduced to 18 when they reduced the voting age.
It seems like the English films are very... Like, the English genre of comic books and that culture is very intense. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Brian Aldiss. He's an English science fiction writer. And as well as some of the comic books, I really love them. There was these series, I think it was post-2080, these authors like Brendan McCarthy, Peter Milligan, and Brett Edwins. They did Strange Days, Johnny Nemo, Freak Wave. They're like this really strange... I think Tank Girl and Simon Beasley also came from that same theme. There's a certain English style that you can't get in America, and I think has pretty much influenced the rest of the world and has created the abstract graphic novel we know today. But yeah, there's a lot of cool things coming out of England, especially it's its own unique English thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think you, the 2000 AD you referred to, which was a weekly comic, which is a, you know, weekly science fiction comic, Simon Bisley and Garth Ennis, all those girls, those guys, I think, started off around, you know, writing for, you know, would want to work, write for 2000 AD, because that was the weekly comic where you got science fiction and that's some sort of horror. But again, it's an awful lot of social commentary. Funnily enough, I do my own show, and I'm hoping to speak to one of the artists who worked later on Tank Girl. Tank Girl's wonderful. Sorry, name has entirely escaped me right at this moment, which I'm totally ashamed about. But yeah, you know, but again, it's that thing of, I think a lot of it comes out of you had your fight with Japan and you had Pearl Harbor. But for the European wars, you sent all your servicemen overseas. You didn't have what my parents went through, which was the First World War. Okay, so the First World War was mostly fought in France, but the UK...
And you see that theme in... Wasn't Pinhead's character was a World War One veteran?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. The Spencer. Yeah, no, and I think this is... You know, the wars that were fought in Europe, we refer to them as world wars because obviously they became global. But London was bombed during the war. When I grew up, I was born a long time ago now, but basically
your Wikipedia says you were born in Germany.
I was born in Germany, funnily enough. You're absolutely, that's true. I was born in Germany. I stayed there for 3 months. The reason I was there was because my dad was in the RAF, the Royal Air Force, and stationed over there. But when I first went to London, you know, when I was a kid, probably about 7-8 years old, there were still bomb sites, i.e. there were still parts of London where the buildings were still rubble or there were large expanses of no buildings at all where grass was growing. And this is going to be 15 years after the war, where it still hadn't been rebuilt. So I think the effect of the war on us in that, you know, in terms of the civilian population is very much different from the American experience of...
Americans have been pretty removed from war. I mean, obviously, soldiers have been affected in their family, but hasn't been devastated since, like, the Civil War.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, so, I mean, basically, you send your... You know, and this is not just... This is in no way denigrating the experience of those families or your servicemen, because they go, you know... All those 19-year-olds who are sent across to Vietnam, that affected a whole generation of, you know, and there's a massive cultural impact of Vietnam, kind of evidenced in films like Jacob's Ladder, and all sorts of things, and you know, TV series, and the MASH was the Korean War. So I think, yeah, and it's not to say that there was no effect, but I think it's on the effect on the civilian population. I think, yeah, our culture is very different. Are you guys familiar with the work of Jen and Sylvia Soska?
No.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, American Mary and... mind is going blank. Dead Hooker
and a movie, she did See No Evil 2, which was WWE film that was entertaining, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, the twin sisters. Jen and Sylvia do a massive blood drive each February in support of Women in Horror Month. And last year, you know, they had their slogan was "Don't be like Hitler," and they had somebody playing Hitler. Now, I wouldn't expect a European to use Hitler in that way, but these wonderfully intelligent, beautiful young ladies who I love grew up in Canada, and the cultural difference, which is why I think I find it interesting. Somebody posted on Facebook today a beautiful painting of Hitler, but it's actually Donald Trump's head. And I think our experience of the Second World War has a lot, is a lot more different from you guys, and you watch your politics from over here. I watch what's going on in America and just think, seriously, don't you remember how Hitler came to power? Don't you remember the loss of rights? Don't you remember the economic crisis that helped propel Hitler to power, and how he made a whole load of promises that he didn't intend to keep or had no way of keeping except by punishing one section of society? I think it's very interesting that the cultural differences and the way we look at the world dependent on that.
Well, I know we're probably running short on time, but one thing I really wanted to ask you about, Hellraiser came out, I think, in 87, right?
Yes.
So that's in the middle of the, there was a big censorship thing in Britain at the time, the video nasties. I don't know if Hellraiser got included in the video nasties list, but what was that like in Britain, that moral panic? I'm wondering if you can give an insight on that.
It's very interesting. I introduced a gentleman, I interviewed a gentleman on my show, on my Google, on my Hangout, Chattering with Nicholas Vince, a guy called Jake West, who wrote and directed a documentary called Moral Panic and the Video Nasties List. No, Hellraiser wasn't included. There are a whole load of stuff that I've seen now, and you just look at it and you go, really? But I think the whole point is, it's not to do with the material. It's to do with power. It's to do with controlling people. If you really want to understand that, look out Jake West's documentary called Video Nasties. It's available on Amazon. I don't think it's available online. It is absolutely fascinating because he really shows how people were just making up numbers. There was one major headline was saying that I think something like 80% of 12-year-olds had watched a video nasty.
I even remember watching this old interview on like a talk show of Clive Barker when Hellraiser first came out. And it's amazing how much the culture changed because people in the audience were so horrified. Like, you see this woman saying, aren't your films going to encourage like serial killers? And then he responded, I mean, today we're kind of used, we were sort of used to horror, but then he responded saying that this is like fantasy and I wouldn't depict something that would happen in reality. But there was a sense of controversy when the film came out, and it shows how much the culture has changed.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But I don't be surprised if the pendulum swings back the other way. There are still people who are saying this kind of, there's still parts of America where, the stuff is banned. People ban films, they burn books. People probably don't burn books recently, but I won't be surprised if you don't see that the way that, not just in America, but in Europe as well, we're seeing it over here. There is a swing away from liberalism towards fascism. I refuse to call it alt-right. It's not. It's fascism. People want, and this is the going back to the original question about video nasties, this is what it's about. It's about controlling people. They published this headline saying 80% of 12-year-olds have seen a video nasty. It was a completely made-up statistic. Completely made-up statistic. But it meant that that Parliament could justifiably pass laws to say, laws which still haven't been repealed in this country, to say that you have to have a certificate, you have to have, it's got to be passed by the Board of Censors in many respects. If it's going to be shown, if your film is going to be shown in public, you've got to pay ridiculous amount of money a minute to have it viewed by the Board of Censors before you can have your film shown in cinemas. So the effect of video nasties is still with us.
There was another effect, I think, though. I've always heard that it became a rite of passage for young young teenage boys to end up watching the video nasties. So in a way, it made them more popular. You know, people would be trying to get them. Yeah.
Yeah, and Hellraiser, I mean, it's changed over years. I mean, I've been going to conventions for 20 years now and talking to people at conventions, and a lot of them, I said, and one of my favorite questions was, how old were you when they first saw this movie? Well, the answer is often around about 9 or 10. I think, what are you doing watching at that age? Oh, I was dared by my elder sister, my elder brother, or the babysitter who bet me $10 I couldn't sit and watch Hellraiser. And I think that, you know, that I don't think that happens as much now because we have the internet and this stuff is a lot more available.
And also horror, it's kind of like pornography. The more you watch of it, the more you become desensitized.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's true. And I don't know that that's necessarily a good thing. I think being desensitized to violence is not a good thing. A lot of horror stuff worries me because of its portrayal of women and the victimization of it. One of the reasons I'm passionately fond of the Soska sisters and their work is because they're young women making horror movies, and they bring a very sensitive take on horror. If you ever watch American Mary, it's very much a woman's film, and it's good, and I think that's good to see. Where it's the men who are being objectified and cut up, as opposed to the women. There are arguments that you shouldn't, and I'm not speaking in favor of censorship. Speaking in favor of people being able to make an informed decision as to how they want to, what they want to show, their see their, what they want their children to see.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Nicholas, do you want to talk about any of your upcoming projects?
Sure. As I said, I mean, I've made reference to Chattering with Nicholas events. I've got a show tomorrow evening. We're recording this on Saturday night. Tomorrow night is my first show of 2017, when I'm going to be talking to a French independent film producer, Anaïs. And I've got Catriona McCall coming on, and a gentleman called Scott Lias, a film director, coming on at the end of the month. So I've got those. My short film, which I wrote and directed, The Night Whispered, is at Macabre Fair Film Festival next weekend. It looks as if I'm going to be in America at the end of February for a convention. I don't think that one's been absolutely publicized yet, but as far as I'm aware, I'm going to be there. I'm going to be somewhere in the USA at the end of February for a convention. But yeah, so keep an eye out for Night Whispered. And then I'm just currently working on more short films at the moment and some other stuff.
And I've also heard there were rumors of there being another Hellraiser film.
Yeah, there's been rumors, those kind of rumors, for at least the last 5 or 6 years. I believe Clive has written a script. I believe he had a conversation with Harvey Weinstein from Dimension Films. In fact, I know he did, because he publicized that he had. I've heard no more about that for at least the last couple of years. So what's happening with that? No idea. I know Clive wants Doug Bradley.
Yeah, Doug Bradley wasn't in the last one, and it was the last one. But you just can't have a Hellraiser without a Doug Bradley.
I think it's very difficult if you're going to have Pinhead, and it's now difficult to have not have Pinhead in Hellraiser movies. You should really have Doug Bradley, assuming he'd like to do it, because I think he was offered both the previous two, and he just said no. I don't want to be involved in these. You never know.
I was going to say, Doug's a great guy, actually. He lives in my city, Pittsburgh.
Oh, okay.
He'll come to some of the cons here, not even as a guest, but just to, you know, see people. You know, he'll pay a ticket to get in. You ask him for an autograph, and he's like, yeah, sure. And you ask him how much money, he's like, nah, it's for free. I'm not a guest here. Just coming in to see the fans.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, he's also incredibly well versed in horror and the history of horror films and so on. And again, I interviewed Doug a couple of months ago, and I love, if you've ever had a chance to read his book, Behind the Mask of the Horror Actor, wonderful book where he traces the whole idea of masks from cave paintings onwards. Really, really fascinating book on horror and Lon Chaney and all the modern, you know, the 1980s, right up to about the 1980s, 1990s. Really interesting book.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Nicholas Vince for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it. It's nice talking to you guys.
And also, thanks, Pillator and JG, Michael.
It's a good show.
Definitely.
Awesome.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for taking the time out to talk to me.
Take care.